So, there is a last topic regarding the usage of FFT, which is performing fast convolution, fastifier filtering with the Fourier transform. The trick is as follows. In time domain, you have a sum of products for performing convolution. When you apply the Fourier transformation, due to same strange property of the Fourier theorem, which I never understood, so of course you also are not requested to understand the Fourier theorem, something magic happens. In frequency domain, the convolution comes back to normal multiplication. So instead of making large n times the product and then summing the result for every sample of the waveform, here in frequency domain you only multiply the spectrum, the spectral line at a certain frequency of the input signal x, by the corresponding spectral line of the same frequency of the impulse response h, and you are done. Just one product, not n product sum. Only one product, no sum. So the computation here is much faster than here. How many fast time faster? Large n time faster. And when n is large, you know, in a church, n can be 200,000. Making the computation of the convolution in frequency domain is very fast. It's 200,000 times faster, incredibly faster. You have the additional computational load of performing the Fourier transform forward and the Fourier transform backward. But this operation are really very cheap in terms of computational load. And they account in the end of less than 20% of the total computational load when doing this trick. So in the end, making this longer path through the FFT, performing convolution in frequency domain and coming back in time domain, is incredibly faster than doing it directly in time domain. So it looks very appealing, and that is good if you already know all the X signals, because it has been already recorded. So for doing the process offline with stored data, this is very good. It's not good for real-time processing when you don't know the wall of X, but you only know the X till now, and you don't know the X which has yet to come. It's in the future. You don't know the future value of X. So you should wait that the singer end his song, and at this point you convolve. But for real-time application, that's not good. You want to make the filtering live, real-time, during the performance. So this traditional way of using the Fourier transform for making convolution is very good on a textbook. It can still be good with signal which are already being recorded. It's not good for live, for broadcasting, for concerts, or so on. Because in those cases you need to make the convolution during the performance, not after it has finished. Second problem. If it is the ninth symphony of Beethoven, it lasts 1 hour. Oh. 1 hour sampling at 48 kHz, it is something like 1 gigabyte of data. So those FFT becomes very huge with a lot of memory. Until a few years ago, this was not feasible. Nowadays start to be feasible, but still it's quite hard to make an FFT of 1 hour of signal, okay? So in the end, it's not really practical to make the processing in this way, even if it is faster. What is the solution? The solution is the overlap and save algorithm. And the overlap and save algorithm is based on chunking the waveform and filtering it in chunks. Not all the song, but just small piece of music. So in practice, the input signal is chunked, is cut in blocks of endpoints. Also, the impulse response is zero-padded to the same block length as the input signal. You perform the convolution of these two blocks of data, make the inverse Fourier transform, and then select just half, usually, of the total output sample. For example, give some numbers here, if not you don't understand. The block is, for example, 2048 samples. You get a block of data of 2048 samples. Your FFT is made by an impulse response of only, this is the impulse response with the tape, of 1024. His mouse today is terrible. 1024 followed by other, you zero pad, so you follow with other 1024 zeros. So the two blocks have the same length, you make two FFT which will have the same spectral resolution, and these two FFT blocks can be convolved because they have the same size, the same frequency resolution, and so on. You make the convolution, and in the end, you get a block which is still 2048 samples. You discard half of them. The first half is discarded, and you only keep the second half. This part. This is your correct output. The first half, you throw it away. Then, what you do? You move your input data windows, not of 2,000 samples, but only of 1,000 samples, as we have seen in the previous hour with the window, with an overlap of 50%, for example, and perform everything again. So every time you make a 2,000 point FFT, but you only get 1,000 point output. This is the overlap and save algorithm. It's very nice because it makes it possible to process the music, the signal, in small chunks instead of waiting for the whole length of the song. Still is not perfect because there is still a quite huge processing latency between input and output, because you are doing this processing with a latency of 2,000 points, which is not 3 minutes, it's just a few hundred milliseconds, but still is noticeable, particularly for a musician. Such a delay between when he plays the key on the keyboard and when he hears the sound is disturbing for the musician. So it's not perfect, it's not zero latency yet. And then, if your response is large, you still need a lot of memory for doing the processing. And then the solution is the modern algorithm, which is called the partitioned overlap and save, or the partitioned convolution, And in the partition and overlapping save, you not only divide in chunks the signal, the music, but you also divide in chunks the impulse response. So, for example, in this case, you divide your impulse response in 4 chunks. But usually you divide much more, in 64 chunks perhaps. Okay? You divide your impulse response in very, very small chunks. Every chunk becomes a filter. And then you cascade all these filters. Cascade. You need to make more effective 4 in this example. But the total latency is reduced to the length of one block, not to the length of the impulse response. Making these blocks smaller and smaller, you can reduce the latency as much as you want, with an increase in computational load, which usually is not significant. Or, as we have demonstrated with some scientific work, there is an optimal chunk size which makes the algorithm even faster than the not partitioned overlapping save. Albeit you make more computation, modern processors are faster when processing block of data of optimal size. The optimal size depends on the cache memory of the processor. And with modern processor, you have fast cache, but small size. So the optimal size is quite small, typically 2,000 samples, or even less, 1,000 samples. So you reduce a lot of the latency. This impulse response can be 200,000 samples, and you divide it in 100 chunks, and you reduce by 100 times the latency of your system, making it just 2 or 3 milliseconds, which is not noticeable even by the better musician. So this is the trick for making fast convolution with little computational load, little memory occupation, so this algorithm can easily run over on a mobile phone, for example, or a small recorder, those Zoom recorders which you can keep in your hand and buy for less than 100 euros. Then there is a very small processor inside, not like in a computer. But with partitioned convolution, it's still plenty enough for doing this kind of FIR filtering. So with this kind of algorithm, you can completely neglect IIR filtering, because now FIR filtering is overperforming the traditional IIR filtering algorithm. And that's all about digital signal processing. Now we are going to use the digital signal processing technology for making impulse response measurement with digital equipment. We will see 3 eras of measurements of the impulse response: the past, the present, and the future. I must say that nowadays, this year, the future is almost present, because what we are describing here as the future, which was the future 1 year ago, is not the future anymore. Because this year, we managed to do the things which are described here. So, it is the present, this one. And all this is the past, today. 1 year ago, the line was here. Now the line is here. So, the past, of course, is to use an impulse source, and the typical impulse source which you fire inside your room is, for example, balloons. Here you see very large balloons, good for low frequency, and here smaller balloons, working better at medium and high frequency. This room is in São Paulo, in Brazil. It was a previous railway station, which has been modified as a very huge concert hall with more than 2,000 seats, and is one of the better examples in the world of a variable acoustic room, because the ceiling can move by 10 meters. So when it is completely raised, the volume is enormous, like a cathedral, with a lot of reverb. When the ceiling is lowered, it becomes a normal conference room with much smaller reverberation time. This instead is a pistol with a special diffuser on the top, so no bullet can come out, of course, no dangerous, only make noise. You see the effect of the size of the balloons. The large balloon has a lot of low frequency, the small balloon only has energy at high frequency. So it's not a very nice source. The spectrum is not flat. They are not repeatable. Some balloons just does not make any sound. You hit it with your sharp object and it makes no noise. Some other explode and make boom. But the type of boom which you get is always different. The directivity is terribly variable. It depends how the rubber breaks, and it radiates more sound in one direction than the other, so it's really a bad sound source. Here you see two professional sound sources. One is a dodecahedron loudspeaker, and one is a firecracker. Okay, this was in an outdoor scenario in a Greek theater, in Patras actually. Here you see the impulse response measured with the dodecahedron and the impulse response measured with the firecracker. Same place, same microphone, same position of the source. As you see, the impulse response of the firecracker is much better than the one from the dodecahedron, because this is a truly point source, it's very, very small, and is truly omnidirectional, and in time domain, it's really very short, it's very close to a direct delta function. Currently, the firecracker is considered the best impulsive source, truly impulsive source. Instead, as you see, the dodecahedron is smeared in time, as pre-ringing, so before the loudspeaker starts, it takes a while deciding to start. It's not that the signal arrives and it boom, bring it out. It makes it's slow, it has inertia, and is mirrored in time, because there are 12 sources actually. They are not very close together. The thing is big, it's not really a point source. So the impulse response you measure with a dodecahedron is in general bad. A small source provides a much sharper impulse response. Also in terms of spectrum, the dodecahedron is terribly colored, while at least up to a certain frequency, the spectrum of the firecracker is very nice and flat. So really the firecracker is the cheapest sound source with €2. You buy a box with 20 firecrackers, industrial grade, all calibrated, perfect same signal, perfectly the same grams of powder, so they all make exactly the same sound. Not handmade, of course, industrial grade, Chinese firecracker. You know, China invented firecrackers. They are the best maker of firecracker in the world. Now, Chinese products come here in Italy very cheap, so you can buy very good grade firecrackers, not the cheaper one. Buy the expensive, €2 for a box. The cheaper are €1 for a box. There is no point in saving €1, okay? So buy the good one, and you have an excellent sound source for impulse response measurement. Then we have the clapping machine. The clapping machine is a nice object, is two pieces of wood which you hammer each other, pam, okay, with this device, it's like clapping your hands in a much better controlled way. All the clappings are the same. And if the device is built with a cavity, you see the lower one is a cavity inside, then you get a quite flat and wide spectrum. With only the wooden table, you don't get low frequency. But with this double structure, you get a very good spectrum, even at very low frequency. Here is how the device is employed. You keep in your hand and pop close together. Here you see 12 shots of the clapping machine, and the reproducibility is incredibly good. Okay? So it is a nice sensor. The only problem is the directivity. Here you see the chart showing you the radiation pattern of the clapping machine in the horizontal plane. You see, this is the plane which is shown here, and particularly at high frequency, but 1 kHz is not really high frequency, it's medium frequency. It starts to become quite directive, it's not omnidirectional anymore. So, in terms of omnidirectionality, it's really not so good. In the vertical plane, it is even worse, the directivity pattern. So, be aware that employing the clapping machine, you can have problem when the directivity effect can cause strange things in your room. If your room is elongated, if you radiate the sound along the main axis of the room, you get one kind of response. If you radiate the sound in the other direction, you get a completely different response. If the room is square, it doesn't matter the directivity of the source. So the directivity can be a problem in certain kind of room. Here you see an example of a measurement of impulse response. This is the main hall of Liceo Toschi here in Parma, the artistic lyceum, artistic high school. And here there is my colleague Andrea Capra, having the pistol in his hand, and he fired the pistol. And this is the sound. Is terribly reverberant for a classroom. In fact, people inside this room are not happy at all of the acoustic of the room. But there are architectural constraints which impede to apply sound-absorbing material to the surface. So it remained as it is now with bad acoustic. Here you see the spectrum of your source, and the spectrum of the pistol is not flat, is bell-shaped. A lot of energy at central frequency, weak energy at very low and very high frequency. Here you see the impulse response measured at each octave band. At low frequency, the signal-to-noise ratio is terrible. Increasing the frequency, the signal-to-noise ratio improves. Now it's quite good, now it's perfect, excellent, still quite good, still usable, not so good, quite bad. So the spectrum, it depends also on the background noise. Background noise usually is louder at low frequency. You see how much noise there is here. However, generally speaking, the traditional method of working can be used, is still used. I make this kind of measurement with pulsed source, mostly nowadays with firecrackers, almost every morning. So this is the past, but it is also the present, because the use of this source is very cheap and very practical. Then, a measurement system is not made only by the source, it's made also by the microphone. And the microphone which you typically use is a normal measurement microphone, like the microphone inserted in a sound level meter. Modern sound level meter like this one are also sound recorder, because inside the sound level meter there is an SD card, and all what happens on the microphone is stored as a WAV file on your SD card. So for going to make this kind of measurement, you only carry your handheld sound level meter and a box of eye tracker. Very simple. You explode the firecrackers and record the response with this sound level meter. The measurement is calibrated, you know the level, you know everything, it makes spectrum analysis, it can also in software making already the computation of the reverberance time in real time on your sound level meter. It's very practical. The other solution is to buy a good microphone and connect it with the sound card of your laptop. This is the other possibility, or with a recorder, a Zoom recorder, something like that. For performing the computation of some type of acoustical parameter, of descriptor of the acoustical quality, you need to analyze the spatial information, the directional distribution of sound around the receiver. This can be done with microphone, with special directivity pattern, not anymore omnidirectional like this one. This kind of microphone has a response which is completely omnidirectional. So it receives the sound with exactly the same sensitivity in every direction. His polar pattern is a sphere. This kind of microphone here are binaural microphone or pressure velocity microphone. The dummy head has two microphones at the entrance of the ear channel on both sides, so here you get a stereo recording, a two-channel recording, which can be analyzed for computing some kind of spatial parameter. Particularly, here we measure the cross-correlation between the signal at the two ears, for checking if the two ears are getting the same signal, which means mono, which means bad, or if the signal at the two ears are significantly different, which means stereo, which means partial, which means good. So, comparing the signal at the two ears can give you information of how the sound in your room is enveloping, is bringing you emotion of being inside the music, instead of listening from the music from far away, as it happens outdoors, for example. When the orchestra plays in a park, no one enjoys the performance, because the musicians are there, you are here, and the music does not belong to you. The music is there, you are far, you're also mentally far from the music. Instead, when you're in a good concert hall, you are inside the music, and the music surrounds you. So this is a good enveloping effect which makes you to appreciate the music much more. So a binaural dummy head is a way of assessing this kind of phenomena. The other way is to employ this kind of dual directivity pattern microphone. This is a microphone which can be set to work as an omnidirectional, or it can be set to work as a figure of eight microphone. A figure of eight microphone is a microphone which has maximum directivity in one direction and null directivity in this plane. Comparing the two responses of the microphone, again, you can evaluate how much sound is lateral and how much sound is frontal. Frontal sound is bad, lateral sound is good. If you don't want to buy this kind of dummy head, which costs 20,000 euros, you can have a 2 euro solution. Just buy a pair of cheap electric microphones and insert them in your ear duct. And then your own head is the dummy head. It's not really dummy. The head. So you make a very good recording, just employing a pair of microphones like that. And I have those here today to show you. Now I give them to you, and you pass along.
This is a pair of binaural microphones.
containing very small electric microphone. When you fit in your ear, you record the sound at the entrance of the dummy, Then there is a technology for capturing the ambisonic signal. What are the ambisonic signals? You know, at the beginning of this course, I did explain you that knowing everything of the sound field in one point means knowing both pressure and particle velocity. A sound field microphone is a special microphone system. You see, sound field microphone is a special microphone system which captures both pressure and the three Cartesian component of particle velocity. Remember, pressure is a scalar, there is no direction for pressure, but velocity is a vector, so there is one direction for the velocity vector, and if you want to know the direction, you need to measure the three Cartesian component of velocity vector. So a sound field microphone is a microphone made of four microphones, actually. One is a pressure microphone, and the other three are three directive microphones pointing along the three directions. This guy here, which looks very young, is Michael Gerdon, who invented, together with Peter Craven, this sound field microphone in 72. So it is more than 40 years now. Gerdon is dead nowadays. Craven is still alive, but he is old. This is the modern build of the sound field microphone. It was one of the early prototypes. This is the current. You can buy it even today. It's still in production, this microphone. You see four capsules placed on the face of a tetrahedron. And this black box here make a transformation of the signal, processing of the signal coming from the capsule, giving as a output four channels called W. W is the omnidirectional, called X, called Y, and called Z. The first one is actually pressure. X is the velocity component along X-axis, Y is the velocity component along Y-axis, Z is the velocity component along the vertical axis. This is a sound field microphone, our sound field microphone. We own a sound field microphone here at the University of Parma, and here we are measuring it in the anechoic room. You see the anechoic room is a room where the walls and also the floor here below this grid and the ceiling are covered by this wedge of mineral wool. So they are completely absorbing. There are no reflections inside this room. You only have the direct sound between the loudspeaker and the microphone. You don't see here below, but here the microphone is mounted on a turntable. And a turntable is a device which makes the microphone to rotate along the vertical axis. Is automated and controlled by the computer. So you repeat the measurement while the turntable is rotating, and what you get are these charts which show you the signal, the level in decibel of the signal when the source was in different direction. What you see here is in blue the W channel, in pink is the X channel, and in green is the Y channel. If the microphone was working perfectly, you should see a chart like this one at a very frequency. Instead, you see that at very low frequency, on that very high frequency, the response of the microphone is not the correct one. So actually, the sound field microphone reminds you to perform this way, but it managed to do it only in a couple of central octaves around 1 kHz, 2 kHz. Then, at very low frequency and very high frequency, it does not behave so well. This is the commercial sound field microphone. Now on the market, the patent is expired now, is a technology which has more than 30 years now, so the patents are expired, everyone can use the ambisonics method. There are other makers of this kind of microphone. This is the API, is written here, DPA4, Danish Pro Audio. This is Tetramic, and this is Brahma. Brahma is our microphone. This has been invented here at the University of Parma and is now sold by a spin-off company of the University of Parma. There is a small zoom recorder, a probe, and a tetrahedral capsule assembly on the top of it. So with this kind of microphone, you can measure the impulse response in rooms. This is particularly handy because you don't need cables, this is battery operated, you keep it in your hand, make your source to explode and perform the recording. Okay? Any questions? Okay. Second breath.